You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Kind of an odd time right now for the AL and NL West as the trade deadline is approaching. I'm Allison Sutter from MLB.com. If we look at the contenders and the teams that are in first place are really struggling, whereas the teams that are sort of out of it have put together some wins. So what does this all mean for the trade deadline? It's very hard to say. Let's talk to our reporters about that.
Clayton Kershaw being on the DL, that sent shockwaves through the nation, being a little dramatic there. But now he had a setback during his bullpen session on Saturday. He's having some lower back problems, and now it looks like he is going to be out. We don't want to use the word indefinitely quite yet, but it's heading that way. I'm stating the obvious, how alarming is this for the Dodgers?
Well, considering the rest of their pitching issues out of their starting rotation, you know, I think it's very alarming. Last year you get to the trade deadline and the Dodgers had, Kershaw pitching well, Greinke having the season of his life. They were trying to get Cole Hamels from the Phillies, but they didn't want to part with the people that the Phillies wanted to make that trade. The Phillies traded him to Texas, and this year really they don't have Kershaw for a protracted period of time. Greinke's gone, and he's on the DL with the Diamondbacks. And so, they're working from a position of weakness here going to the trade deadline with, really, what are they going to do with the depth chart of their rotation the way it is right now?
Yeah, so the way it is right now is Maeda, Bud Norris, Kazmir, McCarthy, and they have recalled Julio Urias, who is very young and very talented, and we can't call him a prospect anymore, but he made 8 starts before the All-Star break, a ton of strikeouts. He struggled a little bit with his command, but their ultimate goal is really for him to not pitch beyond an innings limit, and they're being very cautious with him. So he has been thrust into duty on the major league level more out of necessity and nothing else. And that can really become problematic for them, right? I mean, if anything happens to this kid, then it's going to be like a really bad situation if they've been pushing him when they really shouldn't have.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a two-pronged issue with Urias is that, number one, he's 19 years old, and they don't want to put too much pressure on his arm too early because they're looking at him long-term. And secondly, if they want to make a deal for an established starter, which there's not a real plethora of them around Major League Baseball this time around, even expected free agents who you can rent, Urias is the number one prospect in that organization that other teams are going to want. So you have a question here, and I think there's a major discussion going on within the organization between ownership and the front office. Do you take a long-term view of this and watch what you're doing with Urias and do the best you can for this season? And then, or do you take a short-term view and try to win now by trading a part like Urias for a more established pitcher when you need somebody in your rotation to anchor a rotation which is short right now? And I think that's what's going on, and that's what's going to be under discussion until you get to the trade deadline and even beyond, because as you know, up until September 1st, players can go through waivers and you can make trades until you establish the playoff rosters on September 1st. So there's a lot of time to make deals and a lot of things for the Dodgers to do. People may not remember it, but the big Beckett-Adrian Gonzalez deal that they made in the first blush of this ownership a few years ago was all done in August. All those guys passed their waivers, and they were able to make the deal. So, I mean, there's still 2 months to go before the trade deadline to make.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really interesting with what you say about Urias. Taking on a more established pitcher, which means taking on more money, which is not a problem for the Dodgers. But I don't know. The Dodgers have this long string of injury history with their pitchers. And so it would seem that it could be counterproductive to try to get somebody who's got a lot of innings on his arm and give up one guy that doesn't have a lot of innings on his arm and could really carry this rotation through next several years. I mean, do you think they're maybe a little gun-shy just to take on another guy that might have baggage when it comes to arm issues?
I think that's part of the whole discussion that's probably going on internally within the organization. Remember, there's a lot of ownership part. You know, there's Stan Kasten in the middle of this. There's a number of general managers under Andrew Friedman types who, you know, weigh in on this within the organization. And I'm sure there's a lot of conflicting opinions on what they should do. And but if you think about it long term, you know, the guys that they already have gotten are, say, for Kershaw, doesn't have an arm issue right now. He's got a back issue, and he's been a very solid performer for them, and he came up through their system. But every other one, you know, whether it's Ryu, Maeda, who has elbow problems, you know, it hasn't come to the forefront here since they came over from Japan, but, you know, he wound up with a make-good contract because of elbow problems that came up in their physical examinations of him. You know, these are all Wood was a trade last year. These are all guys. McCarthy was a free agent signing. These are all guys who came outside the organization. They don't have very many pitchers except, you know, for Kenley Jansen and Kershaw right now come up through the organization over the long term who you can even talk about with stuff like this. Urias is one of the few out of this era that they have. So I think, yeah, your point is well taken. If I'm within the organization, you're going to have a major, you know, blowback on this. If you get rid of a guy like Urias and you take on somebody else who winds up with a lot of innings and an arm problem, especially if you get that guy and it doesn't work. You know, last year it was Alex Wood and Matt Latos that they got at the deadline. And Latos was gone before the season was even over. He was so bad. And Wood has just been a guy. And he's been hurt on and off. So, I mean, that was their attempt last year when they had a healthy Greinke and Kershaw at the trade deadline. So, you know, it's a much more problematic position right now. And they're chasing a team in the Giants that has, you know, their own injury problems that they have to overcome right now.
So the Giants have had a really, really great season. Every team that has a great season also is going to have a part of the season where they're just not very good. And the Giants have kind of run into that. I guess it was a little bit disheartening for them to open the second half by being swept by the Padres. Sometimes when you lose a lot of games, but you're doing it against good teams, it's okay. But I guess that they probably had to be a little bit frustrated to go to San Diego and lose three straight, weren't they?
Definitely, Allison, and the way they lost the middle game of that series, 7-6 defeat in 10 innings, really gnawed at them. They had a lead. They, you know, fought in the 10th inning to get a lead, and then their closer, Santiago Garcia, blew the lead. And whenever that happens, players say they can wash it off, as Bruce Bochy would say, but I think that particular defeat stung a little bit. And you know, as I wrote my off-day story, I believe that that strengthened their resolve to try and get some relief help.
Yeah, I mean, we've sort of been wondering if the bullpen was indeed going to be an issue for them. Those are the worst way to lose games, when your bullpen blows it. I guess the Giants are just, like, in a position where, I mean, they can't possibly be, like, freaking out over this, but could that lead to them being somewhat aggressive at the trade deadline, which is actually coming up in about a week and a half?
Yeah, I would say they're not freaking out, but they are being very diligent in working the phones, getting their scouts out there to examine all possible options. So they tend to get stuff done around the trade deadline, and I wouldn't be surprised if this is another example.
What else besides that one game where the bullpen blew it? But has there been anything else that you, like, just by observing the team, watching them play, that has been concerning to you, just from, you know, an everyday standpoint? I mean, it doesn't look like they're their offense has been okay, considering who they're missing. Is there anything else that's glaring about what might be, you know, a cause for alarm as you're looking sort of long term?
You've mentioned the offense has been okay. That's been just that, okay. Nothing spectacular, actually maybe sometimes inadequate. But a part of that is due to the absence of three key players, Hunter Pence, Matt Duffy, and Joe Panik. They were able to, in the first half, they were able to compensate a little bit with some contributions from youngsters and pickups. But now that in the, over the long haul, missing three players of that caliber is going to take its toll. And so they're hoping these three guys can come back in timely fashion. B, if they can't, well, then they may have to go out and do something.
Yeah, so I was talking to another reporter just in general about the NL West, and he pointed out that, the Giants and the Dodgers' records might be a little skewed. They may not quite be as good as the record show, basically because the rest of the division was terrible. And I know that sounds kind of offensive to fans of, the Rockies and the D-backs and the Padres, but it is true. I mean, they're all under 500, and some are way, way under 500. Do you think that there's any validity to that? Because if you look at the Giants' record overall, if they have one of the best records in baseball, they're definitely a top-five team. Is it a little bit maybe exaggerated when it comes down to the actual talent that they have?
I'd say there's a little bit of truth to the skeptic's view. I mean, it's not that strong a division. It's a tough division. I don't think there's anything such thing as a weak division in Major League Baseball. Let's start there. I think it's often a tough division because these teams play each other very competitively. I mean, the Rockies are, tough to beat at home, and on the road, the array of hitters they have, they can give you some problems. The D-backs are, Greinke's hurt right now, but on certain nights they can be very competitive with the pitching, and they don't often beat themselves with mistakes. Who am I leaving out here? The Padres. They've gotten better. They've just gotten better all around, I think. So, I mean, I'm not saying all three of those teams are knocking at the door of the next year's pennant, but it can be a tough division. That said, the Giants have a disproportionately decent record against the West this year, compensating for what they did last year, and that has made a big difference.
The Padres, maybe they were just, well, most of the Padres weren't at the All-Star game, but maybe there was just such good feeling that they continued those. But when I saw Edwin Jackson taking a no-hitter into the seventh inning, I'm like, what is this? Then I thought, well, maybe it's because it was his debut, and sometimes they flummox the opponent when they haven't been seen very much. Is that maybe what happened?
Yeah, I think that's certainly on the surface what it seems like right now, because you don't expect a guy like Edwin Jackson to come straight out of Triple-A and shut down the Giants, who've been maybe the best team in the National League during the first half. There might be something to be said about kind of the city of San Diego just carrying the momentum from the All-Star game into a really, really fun weekend series against the Giants. I don't know if you believe in those kind of things, but it certainly kind of felt like that. They got a great start out of Andrew Castro. They had a fun win on Saturday, and Sunday, Edwin Jackson almost no-hit the Giants. So it could have been some of that. I think there's obviously that element of guy coming up and surprising his opponents in his first start back. So, make of it what you will, but it was definitely a fun weekend after a fun week.
Yeah, I guess sometimes you just never really know how teams are going to come out, because I was making notes for these podcasts, and of course, so the Padres, they sweep the Giants, and then the Angels sweep the White Sox. So, I don't know. Everyone wants to recharge the batteries, and I guess there's really no reason. I mean, the whole time I've been watching the Padres and paying attention in this first half, I've never said, like, I've said this about the Angels, like, oh, my God, that's a terrible team. But I've never really said about the Padres, like, these are just, like, awful players and a bad team. I feel like they've got some youth, and they do have some guys who can play a little bit. And so maybe they could have a good second half, even though they've made some trades that, they've lost the veterans. But what do you think when you look at the second half?
Well, I think that's a good way to sum it up for the first half, because basically what's happened is they haven't really been terrible and across the board at any time. They haven't really been great across the board at any one time. So at the start of the season, their pitching staff was really good. Their offense was bad. In the last month and a half, their offense has been really good. Their pitching staff's been bad. So they're kind of looking to put it all together in the second half of the season. Obviously, they've traded a few guys, and there's still a few more trade candidates. But I think if you look at it, they could. They're going on their toughest road trip of the season right now. But after that, the schedule kind of eases up a little bit. They could string some wins together, maybe kind of develop that atmosphere that they're looking to build in the clubhouse. So they're really more than anything just looking to put it all together at the same time.
Yeah, I was looking at one of their wins against the Giants. So it's one of the games that you chalk up to. We'll take them as we can get them. Walk-off Falk, winning in walk-off Falk fashion, which is always good off of Casilla. I don't know. I mean, of course the Padres are not going to be like, oh, I feel so sorry for them. But at the same time, it's a really hard way to lose a game, right? Like, you just kind of feel for the pitcher in that scenario.
Yeah, but like you said, the Padres aren't. If you think back to, I think it was in May, the Giants beat the Padres on that awkward fly ball into the wind that fell between Matt Kemp and I forget who was playing second base at the time.
Right.
It was just weird. So I think if you look back on that, the Padres will take and they started the season 0-9 against the Giants, and then of course they sweep them to the second half. So they'll take any win any way they can get it, and I think it's one of those things. I don't know if this is true in any other sport other than baseball, but you can come to a ballpark for a team that's 13 games under 500 and see something you've never seen before and probably have a great time. So it was a fun, interesting weekend. It definitely wasn't boring. It definitely wasn't kind of indicative of a team that's kind of sitting in fourth place right now.
Yeah. I think there's also something to the notion that, I don't know, when the second half gets started, and it's like, okay, the teams that are in it, they know that they're in it. The teams that are way out of it, they also know it. And those teams might even be playing a little freer and a little looser without the pressures of I like to think that players, like, kind of approach it the same every day. Sometimes there's just a different feeling when you're like, okay, well, now we have nothing to lose because all we've done is lose. So, you know, maybe it takes, you know, the mental side of the game, maybe that plays into it. Because I've seen this happen a lot where, like, in the second half, a lot of really bad teams will kind of have, like, a really good three-week stretch for no discernible reason.
Yeah, and the Padres are kind of one of those teams that could have that if you look in, if you project in the future a little bit, that could be where they're headed into maybe, like, a fun final month or two of the season. They've got some prospects who I'm sure they're going to call up eventually. And if you look at the clubhouse, they could have kind of faltered after they got off to that awful start against the Dodgers. They had the brutal loss against the Mariners. They traded some guys. And, hey, their offense has still been one of the best in baseball in the last month. And they've played some decent baseball. So, like you said, you never know what's going to happen in a baseball season. But I think they could be one of the teams that kind of plays free and loose down the stretch and maybe wins a few games. And, I mean, they could affect an interesting race in the National League West with the Giants and the Dodgers because they've got a few games against those guys left.
Let's talk about, first of all, just what's going on in the here and now. Zach Greinke, he's rehabbing, but it seems, I guess, to be a little slower. He sounds a little frustrated. What's going on with that?
Yeah, you know, those are bleak things, and we talked about it. Those bleak injuries can be tricky, especially when you're a pitcher and the amount of torque that gets put on you know, that area of your body. So I think Zach had hoped that really he was going to miss one start. I think he had hoped to avoid the disabled list. Neither of those things happened. So I don't think it's taking longer than most people expected it to, but I think it's taking longer than he maybe expected or maybe was wishful thinking on his part or wanted it to be. So he could be back in the next 10 days or so, but he's got to throw at least one rehab start before he would come back, and he's still not throwing full force off a mound yet. So it's as we record this on Wednesday, or Thursday, sorry. So it's going to be a little bit before he rejoins the rotation.
I mean, part of it's just he's not really used to being in this kind of situation, right? I mean, besides the fact that starting pitchers, they get bored enough as it is in between starts when they're actually healthy. This has to be sort of torturous, just kind of not being a part of anything.
Yeah, and watching your team kind of slide, not that, you know, necessarily his presence would have made that much of a difference once every fifth day, but still to be on the sidelines while you watch your teammates kind of fall out of a pennant race, it's got to be equally frustrating for him, I'm sure.
Okay, so 40 and 58, you know, we're not talking about any kind of they still could go on a run, but it wouldn't be enough to be a contender. So I saw that A.J. Pollock is talking about returning this year. I find that interesting. Some of what I've learned just over time, just kind of being a beat writer, being around players who were out for the season, like coming back at the end of that season is like this really important thing to them. It helps them mentally going into the next season where they're presumably healthy, and it's almost like getting them even into like three games seems to make this huge amount of difference in just getting them right mentally. Is that kind of what we're looking at here? Because there wouldn't be any reason for Pollock to rush back, to jump back into a, you know, a pennant race, obviously.
Right. You know, I was really kind of surprised that AJ's recovered the way that he has and as quickly as he has. Because when we first sat down with the doctor, he was talking maybe late September. You know, this was initially right before the surgery. But apparently his rehab is going very well. And I say apparently because, you know, keep in mind that it was during spring training that AJ was telling us that he wasn't going to miss any time and that it was just soreness in his elbow when, in fact, the screw had broken in there. So, you know, athletes always want to come back. So we'll see. But it certainly sounds like, you know, maybe he could be back in mid to late, maybe late August or something like that. So he would have quite a bit of time this year. And I think he certainly would like to have that and would like to feel like he's totally healthy going into next year, as you pointed out.
Okay, so trade deadline is coming up in about a little over a week. And, when it comes to everyone's like, oh, are they going to be buyers or sellers? And there are some teams that are obviously in contention who need like one or two players to put them over the edge, okay, they're buyers. But not every non-contender is a seller. And I know we've discussed this in the past, but the Diamondbacks, to me, are not either. They're not buyers or sellers. It doesn't mean that they don't have a couple of chips that might be able to bring something in, but they really need to look at this like big picture, long term. Where do we want to be in a couple of years? And that I would think that they want to sort of keep this group intact, right?
Yeah, they are committed to this group that they have in this core, and they don't feel like it's the core that's been the problem this year. I think they look at the fact that there's been injuries and, you know, a couple things that haven't gone their way. So they're not willing to give up on this core at the moment. So what I think you're seeing with the trade of Brad Ziegler and with the talk that maybe a Daniel Hudson, although he's really struggling right now, or a Tyler Clippard could be traded, are, you know, at least in the case of Ziegler and Hudson, players who are going to be free agents at the end of the year. A guy like Clippard, who's, you know, a reliever on a short contract. Nothing in terms of dealing away guys that they think are going to be part of their core for the next couple of years, because that still is the window they're pointing towards, was not just this year, but the following 2 years afterwards. So I don't think you're going to see wholesale changes. I think you could see, you know, Clippard move or Hudson move before the deadline. But I'd be very, very surprised if it's any significant pieces other than that get traded.
Can you explain to me how much of an influence he was over you when you were a little kid? I mean, you got your head on backwards right now. And
big one. I feel like a lot of my game have to do because of Griffey. I try to do everything that he did when he was a player when I was little. So I guess that put me on the right spot, you know. He's a big reason why my swing is the way it is, because I try to emulate him. And obviously my swing is a little different than him, but yeah, I mean, he was my hero, my favorite player to watch. And I'm just really happy that he's going to the Hall of Fame with the plays that he deserved to be.
What was it about him, about his swing, that you liked? What were you able to copy and what were you not able to copy?
Well, the thing with Griffey was, he was a lefty, best player in the game by that time. He was everywhere, kind of like, you know, Trout and Harper. You know, it's easy for the kids to like them because, you know, they're everywhere. You know, everywhere you look, all the commercials, all the attention is on those two guys. So that's why, you know, as a kid, you always try to, you know, if you like baseball, you want to go to that path. So, you know, Griffey was the man. I remember telling my mom every night, you know, when they showed the Mariners games, and, you know, I didn't really care about the game. I was just like, just wake me up when Griffey's up to the plate, because I wanted to watch him hit. And I feel like just the way he was so relaxed to the plate. That's something that I take, you know, that I've been doing since I was a little kid. Whenever I get on the plate, I'm not a guy that, you know, they're stiff. I try to be as loose as possible. You know, I really compare my swing to his swing because, you know, the way he swung and everything looked so easy. And for me, it works. You know, for me, that was the case. Whenever I try to be smooth and don't try to kill the ball just go farther. Whenever I try to do too much, you know, I get stiff, so things don't work the same. So that's why, you know, my swing and my game is based on him.
The swing, they talk about the pretty swing. You also have the bat drop, you know, the way you look.
That's him, baby.
Is that
his,
him?
That's his fault, too. Whenever pitchers get mad, that's Griffith's fault. You know, that's not my fault. I've been doing this since I was a little kid. Even when I hit a ground ball to the pitcher or ground ball 2 feet away from me, the catcher had to grab and throw the first. I still do my bat drop. So as soon as I make contact, you know, that bat is going to go to the same spot, you know, right in front of the catcher's nose. And, you know, whenever it's over the fans, you know, people think that I'm just bragging about my home run, but it's not true. It's just something that I do normally.
So how old were you when you started imitating what you say?
Since I started playing, probably, you know, I used to play when my brother teach me at home, and then I started playing Little League when I was 5. So I started wearing number 24 because of him. And then at the end of my career, when he starts, you know, when he moved from Seattle to a different team, wearing a different number, I was kind of upset because he was a 24.
Yeah.
And that was my number. I got called up, you know, with the A's. I wore that number when I was in minor leagues, and then when I got called up, I didn't have the chance to wear number 24 because it was Ricky Henderson's number.
Yeah.
So and then I got here, and then they forced me to wear number 5. So I still think about getting 24 back.
Well, you know, you can pay Jordan Lyles. I'm sure he'd be happy about it. And
I will be happy. He'll be happy. I don't think the fans will be happy if I switch.
Yeah, they spent a lot of money on it.
Yeah.
As far as did you ever have anybody tell you, hey, you're not Ken Griffey, stop trying to be, you know, how little kids are, or how youth coaches are. They're like, why are you swinging like Griffey? Anybody ever?
Do they say, hey? Nobody ever tell me anything, especially, like, because I was raking like that. So, you know, when things work for you, I don't think people, if they say something, it's because they're jealous, so you don't listen to the negative stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, growing up, I always had success playing. I had the chance to represent my, you know, city and the country, and you know, people were happy with the game that I played. So no one really said much about it.
What was your first home run like? Did you think, hey, just like Griffey? Tell me, how old were you and when did it
happen? I was like 8.
Mm-hmm.
I used to play in a small field, you know, but at the same time, no kid hit a homer. You know, because you're 8, and then I was probably the only one hitting the ball out of the ballpark. I remember my mom just jumping around and be like, wow, you're the only kid that hit the ball out of the ballpark, and you're the smallest one, because I was always being skinny. But I do remember that. I remember, you know, when you're little, you don't remember much, but you remember the, you know, things that impact your life. And I remember, like, it was yesterday when I was just hitting home runs in Little Leagues. And the biggest one for me was when I jumped from 8 to 9, which is all the dimensions changed. You know, I was playing in a 12-year-old kid's stadium, which is the normal size for the Little League World Series. And when you're 9, you're not supposed to hit home runs in that distance. And I was hitting home runs, so everybody was like, wow. And that impacts me. That really changed the, you know, I enjoy more the game. I fall in love with the game because, you know, I was doing great things.
And I would ask you when you met Griffey, but instead of that, what was the first time that you noticed that he knew who you were?
Well, I had the greatest experience too, because, you know, my first year in the big leagues, Griffey was, he just got traded from the Cincinnati Reds to the White Sox. So I'm with the, you know, he was in the National League, I was in the American League, and I was like, no, I'm probably not gonna have a chance to play against Griffey. So next thing I know, Griffey gets traded to the White Sox. I look at the schedule, oh, Griffey's coming in a couple weeks. So I was dreaming about it every night, like, wow, I'm going to play against my favorite baseball player. You know, just counting the days, like, you know, like just like a little kid. So finally, the day I got to the ballpark really early. I go outside, see if he was doing something, nothing. And then, you know, I was just hitting regular BP, kind of forget about it because I'm already focused for the game, thinking about my swing and everything. And then Frank Thomas was talking behind the cage with somebody, but I'm not paying attention. So when I walked out of the cage, it was Griffey. So I kind of like stand there and just like a little kid, didn't know what to say. And then Frank introduced me to Griffey. He shook my hand. I was just in shock. And you know, after that, it was all about, you know, fun. And now we live like 5 minutes away from each other. We do trips together, and you know, we play golf together. So it's something that I never thought it was gonna happen.
Thanks, Carver.
You're welcome.